Ladies and gentlemen, good morning or good afternoon. Welcome to the Analyst and Investor Conference Call, Full Year Results 2017 of Landis+Gyr. I'm Iruna, the Chorus Call operator. The conference must not be recorded for publication or broadcast. At this time, it's my pleasure to hand over to Mr. Stan March, Vice President, Corporate Communications and Investor Relations. Please go ahead, sir.
Good afternoon and welcome to Landis+Gyr's Fiscal Year 2017 Results Conference Call and Meeting here in Zurich. And for those of you joining on the phone, thank you for joining us as well. I'm Stan March, responsible for investor relations at Landis+Gyr, and I'm joined today by Richard Mora, Landis+Gyr's CEO, and Jonathan Elmer, Landis+Gyr's CFO. Earlier today, we issued a press release with the group's results, as well as Landis+Gyr's annual report, which included the company's governance, remuneration, and audited financial report for fiscal year 2017, as well as an earnings presentation. If you haven't already, and I suspect everybody here or on the phone has, you can find that on the website under the Investor tab. It's important because Jonathan and Richard will be going through the analyst presentation here physically in Zurich, and it'll be useful for those of you on the phone to have it available during the conversation as well. Finally, after that, we'll open the floor for questions and answers, and we'll go as long as we have time available. So with that brief introduction and a final comment administratively, because we have physically people here as well as people on the phone, whenever we're asking a question from the floor here in Zurich, we ask that you wait for the microphone to come so that the people can hear you on the other end, the other participants on the phone. And with that bit of administrivia out of the way, let me turn the conversation over to Richard Mora. Richard?
Thank you again, Stan, for that, and allow me to welcome those in the room as well as those on the phone today. Listen, it's as I look back over the last 12 months, it's certainly been busy and exciting both at the same time. As Stan said, we issued the results earlier today, and you know, happy to reiterate the fact that we met or exceeded key guidance parameters that we had set out for the group at the time of the IPO. I believe we demonstrated a top line ability to deliver top line results, certainly solid cash flow. We'll go through that in more detail. But there remain challenges, certainly some challenges and areas of focus and execution that we'll get in today in a lot more details. I will tell you I'm certainly upbeat about 2018. And let me just dig right into the presentation. And you know, one of the things we have the luxury of being a part of markets that are definitely growing. And I'm talking about the three regions in Americas, EMEA, and Asia Pacific, and specifically with the Americas. And I'm talking here about communicating meters. You'll see an 8% CAGR over the period December 2017 through December 2021. And specifically, that's 1.2 billion communicating meters going to 1.7 billion. Again, a CAGR of 8%, a nice market for us, and we'll talk a little bit more about what that means, particularly for the Americas business. Moving on to EMEA. So notice here we include smart gas, so both electricity and gas. I would remind you that we are the number one smart gas provider in Europe, and you'll see the accompanying numbers here, 13% CAGR. Again, same time period, December 2017, going through December 2021, $1.78 billion going to $2.7 billion for the region. Let me round it out with Asia Pacific. Certainly a high CAGR, but starting from a smaller base, $300 million growing to $900 billion. Again, a good reference point for the growth that we expect to see. As I start to sort of get into some of the activities in, you know, around the region, there's four that I want to highlight. And the first two are in the U.S., U.S. business, the first being Wisconsin Public Service. A really good example, and you hear a lot about managed service business. Remember, that was a model specific to the U.S., very unique in its nature, long-term service contracts. We added another one, Wisconsin Public Service. And this one is multiple utility, both gas and electricity, 400,000 electricity meters, 326,000 gas meters. The second one, JEA, this is Jacksonville Electric Authority in the U.S., state of Florida. And this is a unique managed service in the sense this is an extension. You know, one of the things, characteristics of managed service business is they're long-term contracts, but your ability to extend them to another upsurge is important, and we were able to do that with regards to Jacksonville Electric. You may have read, hopefully, about PEP and Landis+Gyr. This is a joint venture just recently done in Australia. And I'll talk more about that in terms of the JV, a vehicle for growth for the Australia-New Zealand market. And you may have remembered IntelliHub. This was our investment in 2015, positioning for power of choice, the sort of deregulation market now coming into fruition, although with some delays previously. Finally, we have a nice vehicle for which to grow the business for the future and talk more about that. Let me round it out with the UK. You've heard about in the past the very strong backlog that we have in the UK, and we actually added and signed two new contracts, two new retailers. And just a few hours ago, actually, we got approval on one of the press releases, so I'm at liberty to disclose EDF Energy. EDF Energy is one of the two retailers in combination, combined 500,000 new meters to the backlog. That's Smets 2 meters next generation. And I would round it out with saying that 18 million meters under contract, 5 million have been deployed year to date. So a long ramp to be done in the following years for the UK market. Business highlights. You know, I talked about in my opening remarks the fact that, yes, we were able to meet or exceed the key guidance given at the time of the IPO. And let me get a little bit more specific exactly what that means. Sales growth, a year-over-year, a 4.7% increase, 2.6% in constant currency. And this was against a backdrop of the guidance we had given at 3%. So we exceeded. Adjusted EBITDA, stable or flat, USD, $212 million. And again, at time of guidance, we said $212 million. So we met the IPO guidance. Free cash flow reached a USD, $87.5 million, an increase of $34.4 million, so a nice increase compared to 2016. And I would just remind you of the fact the IPO guidance was in the range of $60 to $70 million, so we far exceeded that $87.5. To round out the numbers, order intake growth, and a nice hefty 18.8% increase, 16% in constant currency, and that equates to about just under $250 million in additional order intake. We reported net income and improvements coming from a loss of $62.6 million to a profit of USD $46.4 million, so a nice increase there. And let me round it out in the keeping of the guidance around the dividend. The board of directors just recently proposed a dividend of 2.3 Swiss francs per share. That's equivalent of approximately $71 million U.S. dollars, computed at year-end FX rates, equates to about 81% of free cash flow. And again, the guidance at the time was a Swiss franc equivalent of USD 70 million. As I move into the regions, you know, some key regional developments, and let's start with the Americas. Fantastic order intake, in excess of $200 million, a really strong performance. I'm very happy with the results for fiscal year 2017 for the Americas, largely led in the U.S. We had really strong uptake, orders, profits in the U.S. business. It was highlighted with strength in public power. This is the municipalities, the cooperatives, where we had a strong presence. Our platform continues to be well used and a nice platform from which to build continued business into the public power market. You may not be aware, we launched Gridstream Connect. This is our utility IoT offering around smart cities, enabling things like smart lighting, really sensor-driven, data analytics supported, so our offering around smart city. EMEA, the momentum continues. I mentioned our strong markets in the UK, Netherlands, and France. But we have some challenges. The challenges were around our capabilities or our ability to manage what I would call an industry-wide supply chain constraints that really dampened our second half, and I'll get into a little bit more about quantification, what that meant, but we had to manage through some industry-wide component shortages. We had some good results with regards to Phoenix. If you remember, we talked about really two cost-saving programs. Phoenix was a target of $20 million in savings, and I would tell you that the 2017 results were good. We actually exceeded our target of $13 million, delivered $15.8 million in savings in the fiscal year 2017. Lightfoot, that was originally predicated around $20 million in savings, having to do with optimizing our manufacturing footprint. Happy to say that we're now targeting $25 million in savings as opposed to the $20. However, gross profit recovery was delayed. We had some delays in the product cost outs, and that will be a laser-like focus for us for 2018 for sure, but there's no other way to put it in terms around. And what was mostly in our control, a disappointment about our inability to deliver on the cost outs that we had expected, and again, I'll talk more about that in the fiscal year 2018. Moving to the APAC region, there's no doubt we suffered with the delays of Power of Choice. I mentioned this to you, but I believe we've turned the corner recently with the Acumen JV portfolio now, and expecting that in this next year and the years to come, getting back to the expected growth that we were hoping to see this last year. And again, I'll have a lot more to say about Acumen and what it means for the region, Australia, New Zealand. With that, I'm going to hand over to Jonathan Elmer, who will go through a lot more of the detailed financials, and then I'll come back and round out some of the specifics in the regions. Jonathan.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'll spend a bit of time going through the group results for FY 2017 in a little more detail. This slide 7, gives the key metrics for the result for the year. So, as Richard mentioned, a good increase in order intake, 18.8% in nominal currency, 16% in constant currency terms, to just under $1.6 billion. Revenue up by 4.7% in nominal currency terms, 2.6% in constant currency terms. The challenge we see on the adjusted gross profit line, which fell by 3.7%, notwithstanding the higher revenue, and Richard and I will talk more about that during the rest of this presentation. Adjusted EBITDA came in at $212 million. Exactly on guidance and exactly equal to FY 2016. As Richard mentioned, we saw a significant improvement on the net income line from a loss of $62.6 million to a profit of $46.4 million. And I'll just spend a moment explaining that big change. Firstly, in FY 16, we booked a $60 million impairment for goodwill, and in FY 17, there is no impairment of goodwill. Secondly, we had significantly lower financing costs by about $25 million between FY16 and FY17, partly due to the refinancing, partly due to some other impacts. And finally, we had lower tax charges by $29 million, mainly resulting from the benefit of U.S. tax reform. So that explains the major swing in net income below the EBITDA line. And finally, as Richard mentioned, 65% improvement in free cash flow to $87.5 million. Moving on to slide 8, which is the revenue bridge for the year. So revenue grew from $1.659 billion to $1.738 billion. We had a very strong result in the Americas, $38.5 million constant currency revenue growth. And that's notwithstanding some reduction in the revenue in Japan. As expected, revenues from the TEPCO project came down somewhat, and that was more than offset by an exceptionally strong performance in the U.S. market. So a real highlight of FY17 has been the resilience of our U.S. business. EMEA grew by 1.7% in constant currency terms, $10.5 million in constant currency terms. We see good momentum in the key AMI projects in the UK, Netherlands and France, but we did have a significant impact from supply chain constraints, which we experienced in the final quarter of FY17. And that depressed our second half revenue in EMEA by about 7.5%. Asia Pacific revenue fell in constant currency terms by $4.9 million, 3.4%. That fall is really entirely due to delays in Australia. Australia has just gone through a major regulatory change, introducing a new setup called Power of Choice from the 1st of December 2017. We had expected the market to pick up during the course of fiscal 17, but in reality, it's still been very heavily delayed. Clearly, with the acquisition of Acumen, we now expect to see the market pick up, and we would expect to be a beneficiary of that in the Australian market. Turning to the adjusted EBITDA bridge on slide 9, as I mentioned, EBITDA flat between the 2 years at $212 million in both FY16 and FY17. So we saw a fall of our adjusted gross profit in constant currency terms of $31.6 million. By far the most significant effect causing that fall was the challenges that we had getting the lower cost products into market in EMEA. So this is not so much an issue of price pressure out in the marketplace. It was really an issue of execution for Landis & Gyr to get our next generation of lower cost products into the marketplace in EMEA. We now have clear line of sight to getting those products out into the market, and we will see the benefits of those lower cost products coming through in FY18. And just to put some numbers around that, our margin for the year, gross margin for the year in EMEA, was impacted by 3.6 percentage points due to the delays in getting cost reduced products into the marketplace. On the adjusted operating expenses line, constant currency terms, adjusted operating expenses came down by $30 million. And by far the most significant aspect is Project Phoenix in EMEA, which on a FX adjusted basis contributed $15.8 million of that $30.4 million reduction. Turning to the adjustments to EBITDA, the way this chart works is that on the left-hand side, we have H1 FY2017 bridge between reported and adjusted EBITDA, then H2 FY2017, and then the full year. So to focus on the adjustments in the second half, the adjustments between reported EBITDA of $102 million and adjusted EBITDA at $103.3 million, a net of $1.3 million. So we had restructuring charges of $6.5 million in the second half. That's all related, or almost all related, to the restructuring programs in EMEA. In the second half, the normalized warranty expenses became a negative adjustment of $6.1 million. And just as a quick reminder as to how we treat normalized warranty expenses, we back out the provisions that we make in our profit and loss account and replace it with the average actual costs incurred based on a three-year rolling average. So the fact that that adjustment has turned negative in the second half tells you that there's no significant new warranty cases that we booked through our P&L. If you look at the year as a whole, our total adjustments are $65.7 million in the first half, $1.3 million in the second half, $67 million in total. And to just run down the full year adjustments, $14.7 million relating to restructuring, the normalized warranty of $24 million, and the special items, which is almost all IPO related, of $25.6 million. But I guess the takeaway from this slide is that from an H2 perspective, the adjustments have been nearly eliminated and no new warranty cases of any size. Turning to the cash flow, strong cash flow performance, 65% improvement from 53 million to 87.5 million. In terms of the balance sheet control, the main issues to highlight are the operating working capital, where we generated $14 million from operating working capital. So we had a reduction in operating working capital, notwithstanding the $80 million increase in revenue. And CapEx came in at $38 million, which is well below the IPO guidance figure of $50 million and well below FY16 of $42.8 million. So a good cash generation result. That then leads on to the net debt slide. Clearly, therefore, we saw a good reduction in net debt from $127 million to $40 million, 0.2 times EBITDA. Clearly, FY17 didn't have any dividend payment within it. Our dividend will only go out in the month of July, $71 million, and therefore, to a degree, the net debt benefited from there being no dividend payment made in fiscal year 17. With that, I'll hand back to Richard.
Thank you, Jonathan. So let me dig a little bit deeper into the regions in regards to some of the numbers. I'll start with the Americas. Again, a continued strong growth in revenue in the core U.S. AMI business. You'll see with some expected declines in Japan. Remember that the P&L for Japan runs through the Americas P&L, the net effect being a $41 million increase top line. I mentioned Japan, maybe just a word or two around TEPCO. Again, the largest IoT network in the world, and just update you on a couple numbers, 16 million, over 16 million meters deployed. It's quite amazing. Over the next few years, we'll reach, probably exceed 27 million. Now, that is going on exceedingly well. We actually mentioned before we signed an agreement, development agreement with TEPCO to continue in probably next 18 months or so, some next generation services as well. If you take a look at the changes in the product mix did lead to what we call a lower adjusted gross profit. Certainly nothing wrong characteristic in the market makeup, but we did have a mix change around the products. Adjusted EBITDA increased 2.3% off the heels of lower adjusted operating expense. So bottom line is Americas continues to perform well, rather resilient in nature and a really strong performer. Moving to EMEA, revenues grew by 6.7%, 1.7% in constant currency. The revenue was impacted. Jonathan mentioned this, what we call industry-wide supply chain shortages. Again, in the next few slides, I'll get into exactly what that means. The adjusted gross profit was impacted, I mentioned, by delays in execution, primarily around the product execution and cost reductions. These are expected to materialize in 2018. Phoenix did deliver on the expected targets. $15.8 million was the target reached. It exceeded a few million in terms of what the target was set for 2017. $13 million, we achieved $15.8 million, and I'll talk a little bit more about that, but well done with regards to Project Phoenix. As I get into a little bit more about EMEA, on the left-hand side is some of the key market developments. I think I mentioned 18 million meters under contract, and this is in the UK, of which 5 million have been delivered. So obviously, several more million over the next several years. But I would say the rollout continues at a good pace. I mentioned two new agreements signed, 600,000 meters in total, 500,000 SMETS 2. Meters, but we are seeing what I'll call a delay. And let me explain, a delay in the adoption of SMETS 2, going from SMETS 1 to SMETS 2. The SMETS 1 will continue to be deployed. So we will continue to ship SMETS 1 meters, and the uptake with SMETS 2 more than likely in the quarter 2 in 2018. In France, historically a very nice market for us, The rollout continues in large way. About 30,000 linking meters, and it's all the suppliers collectively together delivering meters per day, 30,000 meters per day. 10 million meters have been deployed year to date. In May 2018, we continue to be a partner, and with historic market shares about 25% for France. I would remind you that we're participating in a current tender. We're expecting results in the next several months, and this was 14 million meters, a tranche of 14 million meters coming to bid with, again, an expectation in Q2 of fiscal year 2018 in terms of the results. Challenges. Let me be very clear that really we had two issues with regards to EMEA of consequence. We've mentioned a few times now the industry-wide component shortages. And I'm talking about electronic components here, where we had really a tightness, our inability to secure all the components that we needed, and particularly impacted EMEA in the second half. Jonathan mentioned 7.5% of sales that we had orders on the books that we were unable to deliver. I quantified that's about $20 million U.S. dollars in sales. For the fourth quarter, again, that we were unable to ship. We had delays in product cost downs, and Jonathan mentioned 3.6 percentage points at the gross profit level, and if I were to translate that into dollars as well, $20 million in profits at the GM level that we were unable to secure because of really what was largely in our control, failure to execute on the product cost downs. I should also mentioned that you can imagine laser-like focus with regards to these product cost downs. We're expecting them to materialize in 2018. So I would say an extreme focus on managing the tight supply chain. Let me just kind of put it in perspective. We will continue to see tight components, I think, for the balance of fiscal year 2018. However, we should start to see, I would say, it becoming less visible in the second half. So we have some challenges for sure in the first half, but the second half should start to unwind and balance out. And then, again, I can't reiterate enough the importance for us to execute on the product cost downs. I mentioned to you, and I'll just highlight, this is just by way of signaling a job well done. I'm happy with the Project Phoenix execution. I mentioned we had targeted $13 million in savings. We actually achieved $15.8 million, and you'll see the walk going from $173.1 million in terms of operating expenses down to $164.7 million. You will see a 10.1 sort of bad guy there in terms of FX effects, but overall mission accomplished with regards to the $15.8 million savings for Phoenix. I also mentioned there were two programs, Phoenix being one, the other being Lightfoot. Let me just give you a little bit of color around that. The good news in that it is definitely on track. As a matter of fact, we've increased our target for the savings going from $20 million to $25 million. And I would just remind you of some of the actions we've taken, a combination of headcount reductions, well over 200 in the last 12 months. And we have planned closures in terms of manufacturing capacity, and we'll achieve that on one side in the second quarter of fiscal year 2018. Our outsourcing is on track, and this is where we're taking high-volume electricity meter contracts, outsourcing them. Matter of fact, we actually shipped the first meter in January of 2018, and that is going according to plan. I should also add we're outsourcing the gas meters. Again, production on track. It comes with some restructuring, $7 million. In 2017, an expected target of $4.5 million for 2018. As I move to Asia Pacific, there's no doubt a revenue decline is in the face of the slow uptake of the power of choice, which was the deregulation. But happy to say that with the acquisition of Acumen and the joint venture we've created, I'll talk more about the next slide. I believe we've turned the corner there. But with regards to 2017, we had adjusted gross profit of 20.5% below last year, primarily due to mix effects. The adjusted operating expenses increased due to higher costs at our service solutions business, this is IntelliHub, in preparation of Power of Choice. There's no doubt a tough year all around. There's no hiding, certainly, the disappointment that we had, but we stayed the course. We were recently rewarded with the acquisition of Acumen. Let me give you a little bit of color around that. The JV itself, the transaction, we've actually partnered with Pacific Equity Partners, a local-based Australian private equity group, where we own 20% of the JV, they own 80%. The beauty of this vehicle, it comes with 800,000 meters that over the next 5 years we expect to be deployed. And we, Landis+Gyr Gear, have secured a metering contract with the JV to provide those meters. That equates to about $90 million over that five-year period. So we're well positioned to, I think, go after not only the 800,000, but there's 8 million meters at large within the region. And having this service business now predicated from the largest retailer origin positions us extremely well for the future. Maybe just a little bit about the structure. I mentioned 80-20. We should also know that we contributed $25 million. Actually, will contribute $25 million. That deal is expected to close in a few weeks, $25 million Australian dollars. And we contributed the asset IntelliHub into the JV as well. The reason why that vehicle was a sort of 80-20 split, I think it's worth a few words, is the Australian market requires upfront asset financing. These are long-term contracts, and this one is 20 years in nature, servicing contract. So we'll be deploying, the JV will be deploying meters over a long period of time. And so the requirements are the upfront deployment services, sending people in trucks out to deploy those meters, and that comes with a high degree of CapEx. As you know, our business model is rather asset-light, and so it was necessary for us to bring in an asset financing vehicle, and that's what PEP does. We still provide the meters, the beauty of this, the meters into the JV. We also will get parts of the servicing of those meters itself. So it was a nice pairing and a nice business for us going forward. Let me end on the outlook. For 2018, Landis+Gyr expects sales growth of approximately 3 to 6%. The group adjusted EBITDA expected to be in the range of USD 222 million to USD 232 million. Free cash flow between USD 95 million and USD 105 million. Given some of the supply chain challenges that we've talked about currently being experienced in the industry and the timing of our production cost reductions in EMEA, Landis+Gyr expects that the first half of 2018 to be somewhat weaker than the second half. And in closing, the dividend of at least 75% of free cash flow for fiscal year 2018, I just remind you of the footnote there that free cash flow excludes any M&A activities. So with that, happy to take questions either from the floor or those on the phone. Thank you.
Here, and then we'll go to the phone.
Partners, which components exactly are in shortage?
That's a good question. The question is which components are a question that we talked about. And listen, it's not one component. The interesting thing about this is these are transistors. These are capacitors. Generally, not a problem. Generally, not a problem. But because of, again, the industry-wide situation, it's been difficult for us to get what I call the standard components. You would think that it would be things that are very unique to us. It's not. And this is why I think it's industry-wide. So resistors, capacitors, things that generally are very standard in our industry.
We
just an add-on on that one. What are they doing exactly to counter that?
You talk about the industry in
the
general,
suppliers,
or us, Landis and Gear? Suppliers generally, what they do, and this is the problem, it takes time. They, over time, will increase capacity, which is what they're doing, investing in capacity. In the meantime, you can imagine, like Landis and Gear, we're doubling up on orders. We have tried to put safety stock, you know, in position as well. But this, as I said, this is something that we'll have to manage through fiscal year 2018. I would expect to see that second half better than the first half, but it's something that we're having to manage pretty much on a day-to-day basis.
Here, the last one we'll take before we open up the phone line. So, Michael, if you bring the microphone up here.
Thank you, Nick from UBS. So it seems that the gross margin decline was mostly due to delayed product cost down and less due to price escalation of components. So can you give a bit of more color of your supply chain? I think I heard in the past that like 50% of your electronic components are kind of contracted for 3 years. So what do you see in the midterm? Let's assume the prices, instead of deflation, they go gradually up as the economy is doing well and also the demand for those components. And at the same time, you are tied in contracts where I heard in the past you got about 6% of price decrease per year for an existing product. How do you resolve that issue and how severe is that over time?
We don't see significant pressure on the price side for the components. We accept that there is some exposure there in the terms of, you know, the supply side is becoming tighter. Our historical experience has been that will resolve itself and that the sort of general downward trend of electronic component prices will resume. But we can't rule out the possibility that there might be some short-term impacts on the price side for us.
You see your competitors like Itron, they are considering price increase because it was clearly an industry for many years in a deflationary environment, and all of a sudden you see from suppliers, at least there is a risk, if not yet happened, that they're going to increase prices so that you don't get into the squeeze situation. How realistic are kind of price increases for new products?
So I think at this point, no, we're not contemplating any price increases. I think let's be clear. We're talking about in terms of this component tightness in the industry is our inability to deliver on some sales. And we gave you an example of that. The second half was dampened by 7.5%, $20 million. However, we generally have longer-term contracts in place, so we can sort of withstand some of the gyrations that we're seeing now. We will have some expedited fees, for instance, in securing some of those components and getting them quicker into our plants. But we're managing through that. So I want to be very clear that we aren't expecting any price increases, nor would we look at sort of our expenses increasing. We're managing that. Our issue is just being able to ship the orders on hand.
Okay, thank you. For another question on Japan and the TEPCO phase-out. You said in H1 that in the second half it will come with full impact. So when we look at the margin and the volumes, is this really fully impacted by the TEPCO phase out, or is there incrementally more to come?
Yeah, I mean, we did see some reduction in the revenues from Japan, as we expected to, but there is some downside risk also on the Japan business going forward as well. So that there is a little bit more still to come, but the majority of it's built into the, it has materialized in the second half of FY17.
Let's get one from the operator. Let's take a call from the telephone audience, please.
The first question from the phone comes from Ben Uglow from Morgan Stanley. Please go ahead.
Afternoon, Richard. Afternoon, Jonathan. I had a couple. I guess going back to the question just gone by, I just wanted to confirm I understood it correctly. On Japan, I think you did give the figure in 2016 that Japan was roughly 12%, I think it was, of the Americas. Are we correct to assume that in the year, in the fiscal year 2017, that has come down to, I don't know, a low single digit type number, i.e. it has materially ramped down during last year? So that was question number one. Question number two, I'm really trying to understand some of the gross margin movements, because when I look at the group as a whole, you know, you've grown your revenue by 3%, but your gross margins, and it's not just one region, are down by 3 percentage points. Within the Americas, which obviously we'd expect at the gross margin level to still be pretty good, your margins have come from 44.5 to 42.1. And I think you've explained that as a mix effect. Can you talk about why the gross margin in the Americas has come down, and what exactly is the mix effect?
Jonathan, there's a couple of questions in there. Just to go back to the TEPCO one, I mean, you're broadly correct in what you say around the importance of TEPCO. I mean, we disclosed the figures for that in FY 16. And yes, it has come down significantly as the volumes have ramped down, and we have had more competitors come in supplying the boards into the TEPCO project. That is correct. In terms of the GP effects, to talk about the Americas specifically, I mean, in partly, as we said in the past times, the margins on the TEPCO project are a little bit better than average, and therefore mm-hmm. obviously some of the mix effects you see coming through in the Americas are associated with that. And then it's just really a mix of projects, different project effects that we see in the U.S. Market. We don't see significant pricing issues in the U.S. market at the moment. It's more a mix of which projects we happen to be deploying, which tends to be the determinant of the margin that we see between H1 and H2.
Okay. Thank you for that, Jonathan. If I can have one follow-up. If we think conceptually about margins, I know you're not guiding by region for the year, but if we think conceptually for fiscal 2018, is it correct for us to assume that Americas will be stable to down, but your bet is that EMEA can actually go into positive territory?
Yeah, I'd say we're not guiding by region, but yes, I think clearly we have an expectation that EMEA will move into positive territory.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, operator, I believe we have another question on the phone.
The next question from the phone comes from Andy Wilson from JP Morgan. Please go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. I've just got a few questions, actually. Just to follow up again on the TEPCO contract, I just wanted to understand the kind of the two comments that's just been made. The Japanese, or the TEPCO contract, I should say, the volumes are still going to be a headwind in FY 18 versus FY 17, i.e. there's kind of an incremental headwind on the top line, just to check that I understood that correctly.
Not too loud. Hello, Andy, are you still there?
Hi, yeah, sorry, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. Did you hear Jonathan's reply?
Oh, no, sorry, I think I got cut off.
Yeah, and your understanding is correct, that there is a headwind going into FY18 on TEPCO.
Perfect, thank you. Just on the working capital, just trying to understand, obviously, what looked like a very good result this year, given the growth. What should we be thinking about going forward, and kind of have you made any changes in terms of how you're managing the working capital? Because that obviously looks like a good number in the cash flow.
There's been no fundamental change, and I think we've obviously worked hard to manage that line in our balance sheet better. But I don't think there's been no fundamental change to the way in which we've addressed it.
Perfect. And then just in terms of EMEA, and I appreciate that you don't specifically comment around the regions, but just to try and kind of, I guess, follow up on Ben's question, given the orders you obviously were unable to fulfill in the second half or the Q4, we should reasonably expect then to see good growth in terms of EMEA in FY18, given obviously the market's moving in the right direction and then potentially you get a catch-up there. First of all, I guess, is that a fair assumption?
I
us managing through the component issues, yes, we would still expect to see growth in the EMEA region.
And then just in terms of the margin development as well, given obviously how the second half has played out, and you've been very clear about, you know, the various issues that you've had there, you know, has there been any change in terms of your expectation of kind of where that EMEA margin can get to over time? I.e., do you see a change to outlook, or are some of these issues just kind of transient as they sound?
No, I think our mid-term guidance is unchanged, and what we had said, if you remember, was that the EMEA region would move to our 10% adjusted EBITDA, and we would confirm that.
And maybe just a very final question just on that comment. Would we expect this to kind of be a slower ramp then, as obviously you kind of work through some of the issues which you flagged? Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah, listen, I think what we said is particularly in the second half of 2018 is where we would start to see the expansion. So to characterize it as a slow ramp, I think that's generally correct, yes.
That's great. Thank you.
Take one more from the phone before we come back to the floor here.
The next question from the phone comes from Dilip Keshrival from Macquarie. Please go ahead.
Hi, Richard, Jonathan. Thanks for taking my questions. I have two to start with. Firstly, how much EBITDA growth from the EMEA region is embedded in your full year 18 guidance, and how are you planning to achieve this given the expectations of a softer first half of the year? Second is on your corporate EBITDA. Could you provide some flavor on how EBITDA in this segment doubled last year, and how should we think about this going forward?
On the EMEA, we're not guiding specifically by region, but I mean, clearly we would expect EMEA to move into positive territory as we resolve some of the product cost and supply chain issues during FY18.
It was about the corporate costs.
So in terms of the, I'm sorry, I didn't hear your question, Dilip. I have to apologize on the corporate costs.
So in your annual report, your corporate EBITDA doubled to around 36 million, if I remember that number correctly. So if you could provide some flavor on how, you know, what were the moving parts in this, and how should we think about it going forward?
Okay, so, fine. So just to talk about our corporate overheads, I mean, our corporate adjusted overheads in FY 2017 were just over $39 million, and that is consistent with the figure in FY 2016. So there's been no change in the level of our expenditure on an adjusted basis, obviously stripping out the IPO costs at the corporate level. In terms of the recharges that we've made to the regions, they have increased quite significantly. So in FY17, our recharges were $66.6 million compared to $57.5 million. And that's just a reflection of a change of the basis for recharging rather than any change in the underlying cost base. And just to be absolutely clear, to repeat the point, our corporate adjusted operating expenses are unchanged at $39 million between FY16 and FY17. So that's why our profit at the corporate unallocated level increases. There's also about $3 or $4 million of other benefits in FY17, nothing to do with recharges. But the basic reason why the corporate unallocated line has increased is because of a change of basis of recharging out to the regions.
Sure. Thank you.
Okay. I believe there's. I know there's one for at least one more question here in the room. So let's take that, and then we can get back out to the telephone audience.
Yes. Thank you. From Nick Hubis again. Can you explain a bit? I mean, your orders grew 19%, but the backlog shrank by 4%. Can you explain that mechanism?
Sure. I mean, we did see a decline in backlog in the Americas and in EMEA. Obviously, we have these very long-term contracts, particularly in the U.S., the managed service contracts, and they tend to be somewhat lumpy in terms of their renewal profile. And also in EMEA, obviously, we had a very large contract with British Gas, which we worked through. So therefore, although our order intake was well up, it was still obviously somewhat below our revenue line, and therefore we deleted a little bit from backlog.
Was no kind of cancellation or downward adjustments of your service contracts?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Okay, then another question. I mean, again, on your bottlenecks, is there any risk of penalties from customers that you're not able to deliver on time?
Yeah, no, listen, certainly that's a part of some of the contracts. We have been able to negotiate what's called favorable terms with regards to some of the delays. I do believe we had some what I'll call very minor penalties that we paid, but certainly manageable. And we would expect to, as I said, to deliver those products in the 2018 fiscal year. So would not expect anything of a material basis with regards to penalties. No.
And then again to that topic, why did you have bottlenecks in EMEA but not in the U.S. still having potentially the same suppliers? So,
yeah.
So what's different in the two regions?
Yeah, we did have some bottlenecks in the U.S. for sure. We had orders that we were not able to ship, but it was a different flavor. We had really more ASIC-driven, particularly one supplier in the U.S. where we had some issues with. As I said, in EMEA, it was more general across the board. And why I mentioned capacitors, et cetera, there were some very specific components in EMEA, just specific to the EMEA bill of materials, that affected them differently than the U.S.
Thank you. And then maybe a last question on the APEC. You talked that you outsourced the asset financing part, and in the U.S. you also have, with a managed service contract, quite lots of assets in your own book. So is there also a probability we see kind of more such joint ventures also in the U.S.?
I think... I mean, the asset finance we do in the U.S. is fairly small in scale these days. I mean, many years ago, it was a significant part of our business, and obviously the managed service contracts are very significant for us. But these days, the asset finance component is very small. Clearly, if we, we do look to partner with asset financiers because we do see that as a growing opportunity around the world where utilities don't always want to take the capex onto their balance sheet. And it's quite clear that, except with some of the legacy contracts in the U.S., that's not our business model today.
Thank you.
Yes, Mark Postoff, EVAG. Additional question concerning the guidance in CapEx. You were proud to basically say that you only had 38 million CapEx instead of the guided 50. I mean, there's probably many other items that are more difficult to predict than CapEx, where you have certain like timelines and visibilities 100% almost. Were you just over-conservative, or did you want to build in some cautions, or what was the reasoning to over-guide CapEx?
Yeah, I think we were just a little over-conservative on it, to be honest. I mean, we did push out a couple of programs, but basically it was probably just being a little bit conservative in our thinking about that number at the time.
Because the historic rate has always been hovering around these 38, 40 million.
Yeah, historically it's been, yeah, that's right. I mean, it's been around 40 million plus minus, correct.
Okay, operator, we'll take another call from the phone.
The next question from the phone comes from Erly Carlson from Interstellar Equity Partners. Please go ahead.
Thanks for taking my question. When are the lower cost products launched in EMEA? Are they already in the market now, or when would you expect them to reach the market?
And I'll go ahead and take that one. They aren't in large scale in terms of the lower cost products in the market. We'd expect that really in the next coming months. There's really a family of four products that we're targeting. So I would characterize that as over the next 2 or 3 months, and that will gradually build up. Keep in mind, we have to work off some of the different components, et cetera, and eventually get down to the cost down version. And I would expect that, again, over the next 2 to 3 months, wrapping up throughout the fiscal year 2018.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Operator, let's take another call from the telephone audience, please.
We have a follow-up question from Ben Uglow from Morgan Stanley. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for taking the follow-ups, and I'll try and keep them quickly. On free cash flow, obviously a big swing in the operating working capital. Was that completely underlying, Jonathan, or was there any factoring of receivables? Were there any one-off items in that working capital movement? Second question, we've now seen for the last couple of years 24, 25 million as the run rate on the warranties. what should we build into the model going forward? Should it be similar or a little bit lower? And then I guess finally, big picture question. I'm surprised that in this industry, we don't talk more just about pricing conditions and competitive behavior. In terms of the contracts you've been taking, have you seen any acceleration of price pressure coming into the order book?
Let me take the OWC question. No, there's no one-offs affecting the OWC. It's just the normal result, if you like. And there's no factoring or no significant factoring included. In terms of the warranty, I mean, we don't sort of give too much forward guidance on warranty. And I think, you know, overall, we're obviously expecting we'll have some cash out associated with the large cases that we've discussed before, both in EMEA and the US. I think that's reasonably well understood. Obviously, not expecting to have any other significant warranty items as we saw in the second half of FY17.
Yeah, I can address your pricing conditions. No, we're not seeing any. I wouldn't characterize pricing as being accelerated, you know, across the markets. We always have the need year-over-year productivity increases, et cetera, but there's nothing alarming that we're seeing with regards to the contracts that we're signing in terms of pricing, no.
Thank you.
Any more questions from the floor here in Zurich? Then we'll take our last question from the telephone.
The next question from the phone comes from Cyrus Devek from Portsea. Please go ahead, sir.
Yes, hi. Sorry, I didn't hear the. I'm not sure if I heard the answer from the previous question asker around factoring. Was there any factoring in the second half?
No.
Okay.
That was a nice short one. We'll take the last call this will be the last call coming up right now, please.
We have a follow-up question from Dilipke Shrival from Macquarie. Please go ahead.
Yeah, my question has already been answered, so thank you.
I think that concludes the question and answer session. Richard, do you have a couple of comments you'd like to provide here at the end?
Yes, I do. First of all, I appreciate everybody's attention, both here in the room and on the phone, and just maybe a couple of closing comments. And, you know, I want to say very much that we had a very dynamic 2017 for Landis+Gyr and Gear, and certainly we won some major contracts, continued to invest appropriately in R&D, launched a new IoT Connect, our new IoT platform. We had to do some restructuring, restructured certain operations. We were reintroduced to the public markets last year about this time. And last but not least, we met or exceeded our group-level financial guidance. Nevertheless, we still have plenty to do in 2018. We have customers to serve, business contracts to win, and new products to bring to market. We absolutely must bring our regional performance in line with our targets. And I know we have a very strong portfolio. We've got the right strategy, technology, and people to do just that. We'll continue to be the global leader in what is a very exciting industry. I want to again thank you for your time and attention, and we look forward to reporting our first half results in October. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, the conference is now over. Thank you for choosing Chorus Call, and thank you for participating in the conference. You may now disconnect your lines. Goodbye.